genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're live every day, Monday through Friday, here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is smart radio with sharp questions aimed at intelligent guests. It's talk radio done right for the 21st century. If you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is charting a new direction. Each of my guests is discussing subject matter that helps us chart a new direction and take our world in a different direction. My first guest is the Freddy Krueger of sports writing. His slash and burn style leaves no doubt where he stands on the issues. We'll discuss his latest book about the sports moment that changed history in his book, The John Carlos Story. My second guest is a rebel, both literally and metaphorically. She'll explain how to propel our business to high velocity growth from her book, Defy Gravity. My third guest is a financial planner who helps entrepreneurs to grow and maintain their business and helps family-owned businesses ensure success across future generations. We'll discuss his latest book, If Your Money Talked. And as always, if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Named by Unte Reader as one of the 50 visionaries who are changing our world, Dave Zirin is the host of SiriusXM's popular weekly show, Edge of Sports Radio. He's also a columnist for The Nation's Magazine, Slam Magazine, The Progressive, and a regular op-ed writer for the Los Angeles Times. He loves the Mets, the Jets, and the Wizards. Joining us from back east. Hi, Dave. How are you today?
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming back onto the show. Love having you. You are one of my thought leaders when it comes to sports. And the book that you have picked up, The John Carlos Story, very interesting. Now, for my readers and my listeners who don't remember, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, they were the ones that gave the Black Power salute at the 1968 Olympic podium that sparked controversy, and it also had some career fallout for John Carlos. Yet their show of defiance remains one of the most iconic images of Olympic history and also of the Black Power movement. At the heart of the issue is the controversy, though, over a political statement versus a nationalist statement. I mean, Dave, when you think about it, the Olympics are a showcase for nationalism. The politics is country versus country, you know, the United States versus Russia, the United States versus China. So John Carlos introduced this whole idea of internal politics of the United States into the Olympics. Why did he do it? What was he hoping to accomplish?
Well, at the time, there were really two United States at work. I mean, the 1968 Olympics took place among a backdrop of tremendous division in the United States. And there were serious questions on the table as far as what kind of rights would people of African descent, would women, would people who were against the war in Vietnam, what kind of rights would they be afforded in the country? I mean, this was, of course, the year of Dr. King's assassination, Robert Kennedy's assassination, the police riot that took place outside the Chicago Democratic Convention. So this was not exactly normal times by any stretch. And John Carlos and Tommy Smith were going into these Olympics with a backdrop of trying to keep South Africa and Rhodesia outside the Olympics because of their apartheid policies, of trying to hire more African-American assistant coaches for the U.S. track and field team, of taking a stand against Avery Brundage, who's the head of the International Olympic Committee, because of his own very, very dark past with favoring Adolf Hitler for the 36 Olympic Games. And so they said, why should we run in Mexico City only to crawl home? You know, it was felt that they had to say something, because to stand there and just say USA, USA would be to project a lie to the world about how they felt the USA was going.
All right. Well, that's a very interesting perspective, Dave. But, you know, many people were shocked when John Carlos would inject his personal and his racial identity above national identity. Because, after all, that's what the Olympics were all about, was the national identity. And so what did he hope would be the result of his raising his fist on the podium when he won the bronze medal at the Olympics?
Well, two things. First of all, I mean, first, it was never meant to be the expression explicitly of racial identity. It was meant to be much more a statement about humanism. And that's why they wore badges that said Olympic Project for Human Rights, not Olympic Project for Black rights or African American rights, but human rights. And the third person on the podium, the Australian Peter Norman, also wore a button that said the same thing, Olympic Project for Human Rights. So it was more of like a power to the people as opposed to black power in terms of the exact message they were trying to get across. But that doesn't speak directly to your question. And it was one of those moments where in history where they felt like if they did this, if they didn't do it, they would have their 15 minutes of fame and be forgotten by the next news cycle. But they felt that if they did do it, it would spark a conversation. I don't think they realized, well, I know they didn't realize the kind of personal price that they and their families would pay for doing it, but they felt like it would start a conversation that the country needed to have, and they felt that there was no place more appropriate to start that discussion than at the Olympic Games, particularly those 68 Olympics, which were the first games ever broadcast internationally in Technicolor.
Yeah, those were memorable games indeed. Well, you talk about the controversy that this brought on John Carlos and his family. He did not know at the time the far-reaching consequences that this would have. Talk to us about what has happened in his life as a result of the raised Black Power fist on the podium.
Well, it started with really the news reports that came out right afterwards. Unlike today when we have the internet and people can do interviews or post their statements on blogs or even film themselves speaking and put it on YouTube, I think a younger generation has no idea how centralized and tightly controlled global media was at that time. And so there wasn't really an opportunity for them to articulate for themselves why they did what they did. So from the very beginning, they were just absolutely trashed by the main media outlets in this country. I mean, the Los Angeles Times, their headline about it was about they engaged in a, quote, Nazi-like salute. And a young sports writer named Brent Musburger described them as dark-skinned stormtroopers. Now, or sorry, black-skinned stormtroopers was the words he used. Now, the irony of that, given that one of their stands was actually against Avery Brundage, for his role in bringing the Olympics to Hitler's Germany in 36, was lost on people at the time, and because they didn't have the opportunity to say it. So as soon as John Carlos made it home back to New York City, where his father was on his deathbed, who he was very close to, I mean, his own father was pointing at the newspaper and just saying, son, how did I raise such a terrible person who would do something like this? And he had to have this discussion with his dad where he said, no, you know me. I'm not the person in the newspaper. I'm me. I'm the person that you know. But that's how powerful the media was, particularly on that older generation who don't have the same kind of like knee-jerk distrust that we have today of what's written in the papers.
Right. We had not come up on Watergate yet, so it had not tainted us of our view of the media at the time. I'm sorry, Dave. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go on.
Oh, no. But that's just the first couple of months. So let me just fast forward here and say the inability to get work was the first thing. The inability to find employment, being blackballed, pardon the expression, from the international track and field community. His wife not being able to find work. His kids being made fun of and harassed in school. And then the letters started coming in and the hate mail and dead animals sent to his house, bullets sent to his house. I mean, it's hard to even put into words, like, how high-pitched the moments were at the time, except just to say that in 1977, John Carlos's wife, who he'd been married to since 1966, she took her own life in 1977.
Oh, tragic.
They'd been estranged for a couple of years at that point. One of the reasons they were estranged is that somebody, could be the FBI, but the people were sending pictures to the house of young women saying, this is who your husband is sleeping with, addressed to her. And it was this campaign of harassment that was just occurring around their family. And she took her own life. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point where John really just pulled it together. And from the late 70s and through to today, the last 30-plus years, he's been working as a guidance counselor in the California public school system and just going to work and trying to raise his kids. And when he saw an opportunity to actually finally do his story and got in touch with me, I absolutely leaped at the chance.
My guest is Dave Zirin, author of the book, or actually co-author of the book, The John Carlos Story, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. Now, Dave, one of the things that people at the time still remember from that incident is John Carlos's background and how his background influenced his demonstration there on the podium at Mexico City. He was raised in Harlem, obviously a very gifted athlete, but he was raised in Harlem at the exact same time of Malcolm X. And so what influence did Malcolm X and that whole controversial scene in Harlem at that time play on his outlook towards life and his gesture at 68?
Well, it gave him a sense of, in other words for it, of manhood. And it wasn't just Malcolm X's words. It was Malcolm X being one of many people who had different politics, but who walked the streets of Harlem among the people with this definite projection of manhood. And these are people like Malcolm X, but also Adam Clayton Powell, Jackie Robinson, Roy Campanella, Duke Ellington. I mean, these were all people who were just around. John Carlos grew up right in between the Savoy Ballroom and the Cotton Club.
Mm.
And so to have that kind of presence around you was to be raised with this idea in the 1950s that to be black was to be beautiful and to be black was to be strong. And then John Carlos got a track scholarship to go to East Texas State in Commerce, Texas, which had only been integrated for a year. And to go from that situation to the Texas situation, get to land at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport and have colored and white bathrooms and water fountains, and to be greeted by your new coach by him calling you boy, and I mean, it was a culture shock, to put it mildly.
To say the least.
And it wasn't a culture shock that he was necessarily prepared for at the time either, having never really been out of Harlem in his life up to that point.
Hmm.
So it was the kind of culture shock that when he was given the opportunity to be part of the Olympic Project for Human Rights, it was not a difficult decision for him at all. It was actually a logical decision.
All right, that makes sense. My guest is Dave Zirin. Dave, I need you to do a little compare and contrast of two events from approximately that same time period for their impact on racial justice and their impact on sports. One, of course, is the one that you've written about, John Carlos's raised fist at the 1968 Olympics. But the other one happened a year later, and that was Curt Flood's free agency lawsuit in 1969. How did these two events advance the cause of racial justice and change the nature of sports forever?
Well, I would say that the Curt Flood case, I mean, advanced the cause of economic and workers' justice at that time, because until then, and you still hear this argument today, baseball players or any athletes weren't really seen as workers. They were seen as people who were lucky to be paid to play a game. And Curt Flood was somebody who challenged that, not on the basis of his salary, which he actually didn't really have a problem with, but on the basis of the fact that he didn't have freedom of movement, that his original club really did own his rights. And it had a racial cast to it. He referred to himself as a well-paid slave. But he was also, being from Oakland, he was very influenced by the period at the time. But that Curt Flood moment and was something that reverberated just far beyond the sports page. And it gave baseball players a sense that we're a part of something bigger and that we are part of this moment that's happening in U.S. society as all kinds of groups and people are striving for greater freedoms. And I think that that's the thing where there's that resonance and connection. The difference, and I think this is the thing that separates John Carlos and Tommy Smith, from a lot of moments from this era that we could talk about, is this idea of using the platform of sports itself and the spotlight of sports itself to make a kind of expression, a gesture, to seize that moment, to be able to get people talking, really like imposing what you're thinking and feeling on the national discussion. Like the equivalent, for example, would have been if, say, in the middle of the game, Kurt Flood had just put his glove down and walked off the field and forced people to actually confront what it was he was going through. Now, I think people would have objections to an athlete doing that today, and that's, I think, why it still retains its power, the image of Carlos Smith. The reason why when we've been going on this book tour, I mean, the crowds have been much bigger than I could have hoped in my wildest dreams, and they're also younger than I ever could have hoped. And I think it's because of the image and the moment itself is not only striking, but it also is incredibly inappropriate. And I think that's what still captures people's imagination, like what would cause people to step so outside their comfort zone at the Olympics of all places.
Without a doubt. My guest is David Zirin. He's the author, a co-author of the book, The John Carlos Story, The Sports Moment That Changed the World. Dave, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book, The John Carlos Story?
Well, if nothing else, I'd want them to take away the idea that you don't have to be able to run 100 yards in under 9 seconds to be like John Carlos or to emulate John Carlos. It's much more about standing on a set of principles and being willing to fight for those principles, even in difficult times. And there was a real effort when we wrote the book to separate it from your typical athletic autobiography or memoir, which is usually very much rooted around a very specific set of experiences that actually distance the athlete from the reader. And it's just about looking at the athlete and saying, wow, what a god amongst men that person is. And we're like, no, we're not going to do that for this book. It's going to be a story about his interactions on a street level with other folks and being influenced by people who weren't athletes, and him just using the fact that he was an athlete as the place where he would decide to make his stand, but with an explicit message of it's not about being an athlete or not being an athlete. It's about finding out what you care about, and citizenship is about the full expression of that.
Right. My guest has been Dave Zirin, co-author of the book, The John Carlos Story. Dave, you've probably piqued the interest of many of my listeners. If they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, I would actually, two places. If you want to read my stuff, you can go to edgeofsports.com. But if you want to find the book, I would go to the Haymarket Books website. That's haymarketbooks.org. And the reason why I'm saying Haymarket Books is because the book has done so well, it's actually now on back order at Amazon. They're trying to get more copies in as we speak. But there are books if people like right now want to get it on an impulse. Go to haymarketbooks.org. You can order it, and it'll be at your house the next day.
Wow, that's a great tip, especially with Christmas right around the corner. Dave, thank you so much for being a return guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Oh, my privilege. Thank you.